Today is Thursday, the 9th of November, 2017, and it is block height 493,840. Welcome to another episode of Block Digest. How are you doing, everyone?
Hey, how's it going?
Good, Rick. Good to see you again.
Monkey.
Two X back on. We in for another round?
Yes, this anonymous BitPico person with their own client implementation that somehow has a third of the network hash rate himself is going to charge for it.
Dude, that fake news got everyone in Whalepool all psyched out and they all market sold. It was like this 15-minute red candle that was just because somebody posted the link. Wow, not That's funny.
Crazy emotion right there.
Yeah, it is. Just goes to show. All right,
because they think, oh no, which way are they thinking it's going?
I know. I said, well, it's bullish in either case, surely, because everyone's going to get their free tokens as planned. So surely they want to buy it, and if it's fake, it goes up anyway, right? It's like win-win. Anyway, and welcome Acnix as well. How's the Bitcoin bus?
Bussing it.
Is that it? When are we going to get pictures?
When it's a little less, when it's done.
Yeah.
Still working on it.
Looking forward to the kinks.
Got to get it.
I'm looking forward to it.
Fully renewable or hippied out, something like that.
Yeah, man. Cool. All right. Let's get started. Got a lot of stuff to cover today. One of our favorite journalists, Kyle Torpy, starts us off with, here's what's next for Bitcoin now that 2x fork is not happening. I thought we weren't going to do 2x stories anymore.
Well, we're not commenting with like the running section of who's wised up yet. It's what's coming next. Now that we don't have to deal with this contentious fork, people can actually implement SegWit. But
they could already, yeah. Right? I mean, yeah.
They could have, but they didn't, because they wanted to make sure the community got this thing that we know you guys want, even though everybody, everywhere people are looking are screaming, we don't want this.
Right. Okay, so what is happening next?
Well, it's really a whole litany of things. I mean, Kyle here just kind of touches on how blockchain info, which claims, and I'm using air quotes, although you can't see it, claims to have 40% of all on-chain transactions. bullshit. But, you know, businesses can actually spend time implementing SegWit. I believe Bitstamp just announced that they are today. Hopefully Bitfinex now has some time to do this, that they don't have to juggle around resources to deal with 2x, you know, Coinbase. So a lot of the big transaction generators can actually start making sure their customers save money by applying their dev resources in the proper places. And also he kind of touches on Rootstock and Liquid, which hopefully will both be going live by the first quarter around there next year. So we should actually see two sidechains, one porting via the Ethereum logic to the Bitcoin token, if successful. I'm personally very skeptical of it, but if successful, that would be or bring a lot of new functionality to the Bitcoin network and kind of really leave the question hanging there, well, what's Ethereum for at this point? And then Liquid from Blockstream, that in combination with Lightning Network being a widely available thing is something I am psyched to see, because those two things together should give us a much more accurate assessment of how much on-chain activity is actually just traders. Because now people who are like running arbitrage or frequently moving coins between different exchanges can move all of that traffic into Liquid and have a much faster, cheaper confirmation method other than relying on the main chain. And any traders who don't really pull arbitrage like that or who aren't really comfortable with the custodial model of things can start using Lightning Network channels to maintain as much individual control over their funds as possible, i.e. Like, as long as they're not in an active position, everything that they have a channel open for can be moved back to their end, or exchanges can open up new channels to pay out gains that they've had. So this, if most of the on-chain activities is traders, which I personally believe it is, should free up a fuck ton of space in the main chain because all of these traders can now, they have other alternatives. And that would be very helpful for other use cases, which are kind of being priced out right now, and really just push us to a place where we can think about optimizing how we use block space instead of just screaming for more of it, which is something I don't see very many companies at all in this space thinking about.
So I'll be able to buy my coffee by, you're saying, February, the latest?
Hopefully.
All right. Wait, so I won't need Bitcoin Cash anymore.
I can buy my coffee with Ethereum with Bitcoin, right? I can double it up.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think blockchain.info said that we should all be using Ethereum, right, to do if we want to transact. So what, do I have to buy Ethereum with Bitcoin and then buy my coffee with Ethereum? How's that going to work? And what are we going to need Bitcoin Cash for if we can just buy it all with this?
I was kind of curious how that all works. You know, I was watching, flipping through YouTube, and I saw Junseth had made a post from Junseth's World not too long ago because he bought a pizza with Bitcoin Cash, or Michael Tidwell bought him a pizza and with Bitcoin Cash, and he went to go pick it up. And I really wanted to comment on there. It's just like, who accepted that Bitcoin Cash?
Yeah. Monkey. Moving on.
Yeah. The Newberry tweet storms actually kind of feeds into this. It's because, like Kyle, like I said, just kind of touched on those two side chains for the most part. But Newberry's tweet storm here, it really, I think, kind of lays it all out. Like, there's still work to be done on Schnorr signatures, and most importantly, the signature aggregation there. So effectively, what we've done with SegWit is isolate the signature and script data in its own block space, so to say. Now with Schnorr signatures and the possibility for aggregating those, we can really condense that. So let's say you have a transaction that has 10 different inputs. Right now, that requires 10 signatures. Well, with Schnorr aggregation, you can boil that down to a single signature. So this affects any transaction that has more than one input. This affects multi-sig wallets, which would also include payment channels. And it is a huge jump in streamlining how data is handled on the main chain, because the signatures are generally the biggest chunk of a transaction data-wise. And then also Jonas Schnelli, he actually also has two other BIPs, 150 and 151, to end-to-end encrypt the communications between nodes and actually give you your node kind of like a public key that functions as an identity, so that you can more securely do something like hook a light wallet up to your node and know it's your node, know there's no funny business. He's also proposing something now so that prune nodes can relay blocks, because right now the way the peer-to-peer logic is, they don't actually serve up blocks. And this would allow them to kind of have a way to gauge like how far back their blockchain directory goes, and actually be able to help the network out more than just validating their own transactions. As well, we've obviously got the Blockstream satellite live now, and Nick Szabo working on radio relays. Well, Fiber is continuing to be optimized, which is actually where the feed for Blockstream Satellite comes from. We've got four different Lightning wallet implementations, three different GUI clients for that right now, working on optimizing the proofs necessary for things like confidential transactions. I mean, there is just a shit ton of stuff. Oh yeah, Mast. I left out Mast, but like there is just a yeah, the dam is about to burst, and we're about to see a shit ton of different improvements start piling up on each other, and it's very exciting.
10K inbound, I think. $10,000 per Bitcoin inbound. Right now, we're bouncing off of support at 7K as I speak. All because of you, Monkey. I'm not around. Like that price bounced as we were putting the news desk together. So they knew this was coming. Wall Street knew this was coming. Should we go on to the WikiLeaks story? Shani? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this is a little, there's going to be a little bit of a fake news element to this, because to start off with a description of what this is, WikiLeaks has just released some code for what they call, or what the CIA called Hive. And it's basically this communication platform for the CIA to be able to exfiltrate data in a covert manner from machines that they have infected with malware that you can learn more about in the previous release, which is called Vault 7. And so what Hive is, I can explain what Hive is. Hive is just the communication platform, and it uses a public-facing website that when you visit it, or when a user visited it, they wouldn't, if they are not infected with the malware, it would be very inauspicious. They wouldn't see anything wrong with it. But if it's a user whose machine has been infected with the malware, that malware then communicates through the server. And it has, I think it's called optional client authentication. So basically that means it establishes a secure connection with through this platform with the hidden CIA server. That's where they collect all the exfiltrated data. So the part that's been controversial about this story is that what WikiLeaks has released is an example of one of the certificate authorities that the CIA used for this communications platform, and the subject line of the public key that they used for that had Kaspersky Labs in it. And if you're not aware, Kaspersky Labs is the antivirus company based in Moscow that was recently blacklisted by the US Department of Homeland Security because there are allegations that they spied on US government officials for the Russian government. Now, I'm not going to get into that, but obviously it's entirely possible that the Kaspersky Labs Certificate Authority is not the only one that they use. There's probably more than that, just because, you know, they would want to have as many covers as possible. So personally, I think there's probably more, but WikiLeaks has so far only released this sample that was impersonating Kaspersky Labs. And I also want to clarify that the reason part of this is fake news is some people are reporting it as the CIA hacked Kaspersky Labs, or CIA had stolen their certificate authority key or something. And that's not at all the case, at least from what's been released with this data. Basically, all they did is they created their own key, but then in the subject header, they put Kaspersky Labs so that if anyone did happen to come across the hidden server and realize what was going on, they would assume, at least initially based on the subject line, that it was Kaspersky Labs and not the CIA. So that's mostly what's happened.
Yeah, I mean, it really, it shows like how, one, just how insidious and like Machiavellian like a lot of these intelligence agencies get when it comes to like it taking advantage of flaws in technology or utilizing technology as a surveillance or like a assault tool, I guess you could say. And like the other thing that really bothers me is just like the hierarchy that like all of these like certificate authorities and like things like the DNS system, like everything we use to actually verify who we're dealing with or find a path to some person we want to deal with digitally speaking on the internet, it's all based on like hierarchies. And at the end of the day, like that in itself is a huge weak point. Because, I mean, like, you know, you said this time they essentially just crafted their own certificate and, like, put Kaspersky's name on it. But there have been instances in the past, like for Stuxnet, for instance, they actually stole legitimate certificates. And, like, it's, like, all of this is running on just that basic, like, insecure substrate as far as software and hardware. So, like, it's literally impossible to keep this shit completely secured. And, I mean, it's almost kind of like the fog of war in like video games. Like there is just this complete obscurity of almost everything that introduces some factor of doubt into anything you try to analyze to draw a conclusion.
Yeah, and there's also a bit of irony in the fact that they used an antivirus company for their certificate authority in order to exfiltrate data with their malware. That's a bit weird.
Mm-hmm. And I just like the other part, like the optional user authentication that they were using to kind of hide like the server for just people who kind of stumble upon these domains and weren't infected with the malware. Like it shows like a huge intricacy in the way that they try to structure these things. I mean, like it's like what the hell was it? That the ransomware that hit the NHS a while ago that was literally found and shut down because of the domain name that it was calling to being found. Well, like when we look at the CIA applying things like this, they have a very careful, structured way to hide that connection between a piece of malware and the server they're using to coordinate it. And then behind that, the other layer of like the certificate with Kaspersky's name on it. And it's just like, it's layers and layers of misdirection and carefully like covering their tracks through that obscurity. And like that's something that like you can't really just fix. That's a part of the landscape that just kind of has to be taken into account and dealt with as things happen. And it's like, it's for things like, you know, sending your mom a nice like catch up on Facebook, like, okay, the internet works for that. But we run huge chunks of our economy on the internet, on this piece of infrastructure that is just innately vulnerable in this way because of how it's structured. And like, you know, when we look at what we're trying to do with Bitcoin, like it almost necessitates at the end of the day taking all of this infrastructure that it itself builds on back to the drawing board. Otherwise, how can you make the claim in the long run that Bitcoin or something like it will stay secure? Like if everything that it's running on top of is just fucked down to the root.
Indeed. Well, you only know with zero knowledge proofs, am I right?
That's a promising thing, but those are very new and untested.
All right, should we move on to the next story? For the SEC, Rick, is this yours?
Oh yeah, man, the SEC, right. Starting to come in here. Well, this guy, at least Jay Clayton, the SEC chairman, he was giving a speech and just sort of made an off-the-cuff comment saying that, you know, these ICOs are trouble here. Let me get up exactly what he said. He said during the speech, he was giving a speech on transparency and wrongdoing. And so I guess that's why it came up. And he said, I have yet to see an ICO that doesn't have a sufficient number of hallmarks of a security, which, you know, I mean, that says like he's looking at this like these are pretty much securities. And he goes on, he says, ICOs may need to register deals with the SEC and provide investors with extensive disclosure documents, depending on how broadly they market them. He also warned that many of these platforms were susceptible to manipulation and other fraudulent practices by ICO insiders, management, and better informed traders. And, you know, he was approached after the speech to sort of ask why he talked about that for a minute. And he said that, these ICOs resemble traditional stock offerings, with the only difference being the new fundraising tools involves tokens and distributed ledger technology. He said, when you depart from the Bitcoin or Ethereum network and you get into these tokens, the hallmarks become pretty clear. So that sounds like coming from the SEC chairman, that sounds pretty much like, you know, all these ICOs better be watching out and starting to do some due diligence about the work that they're putting in. And it even goes in there to talk about, you know, now it's going to be pretty common practice with these ICOs to have a lawyer on board to advise them on what to do and not so fast and loose with just sort of creating a token and saying, we're going to release it and here it is. And it, yeah, I mean, like, I think we were expecting this with the DAO, the parity, you know, I mean, it's just going to keep continuing on until something happens as far as regulation on these things.
Polkadot, not parity. Parity was the wallet.
Sorry.
Yeah, Polkadot was that one, but they've lost their funds now anyway. So how can they be a security? That's not very secure. I mean, you could argue that Ethereum doesn't qualify as a security because it's not secure, right? It's totally insecure, right, Monkey? That could be their defense, though, to be fair. I'm not a lawyer.
We don't
that's
know
for free, by the way.
Those funds could be watching. Coming back.
That's free legal advice if Vitalik's watching. Just claim you're not a security because you're not secure. I think most of these SEO, these ICOs have, I said SEOs because that's pretty much what they are, just SEO people. But they already have, like the smart ones, the big ones already have got legal expertise and most of them set up offshore. And they just claim that they're not advertising this Americans. Jeanine, do you want to come in?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I saw a story recently that there was an ICO that had fake people on its list of people that were involved in the ICO, which I thought was funny. Like, if I guess if some of these ICOs are worried about the SEC coming after them, they can always they can always add a fake lawyer to their webpage. But I guess if the SEC really does come after them, then that's going to come back to bite them. Like, oh shit, we don't actually have a lawyer.
Harvey Birdman, attorney at law.
I think we're going to see lots of legal shenanigans before it gets clamped down.
Indeed. Moving on then. Plenty of time. Parity rep says startup won't push for an emergency fork. Does that imply that there will be a hard fork then to get the funds back from the Parity wallet debacle? Whose story is this?
I think most definitely so. I mean, we talked about this a little bit yesterday, how there's, you know, Ethereum's got a roadmap with hard forks in it. And one of the ones that's coming up is called Constantinople. And what exactly that hard fork all entails, I'm not entirely sure, but I did kind of figure this was going to happen. It's like maybe to avoid sort of the bad publicity that the DAO had as far as being called a bailout because it looked like a bailout. It was an emergency hard fork to simply get that money, where now they've got these sort of scheduled forks in the road to where, you know, these guys, I'm sure they've got enough funding to sort of hold them over and until these scheduled hard forks come in, and then they can start discussing about, you know, unlocking and unfreezing these funds.
Well, in this case, wasn't the resolution they came to that they wouldn't pursue a hard fork specifically for parity, but they would wait until the next hard fork and then just batch it in with that one? Yeah, I think that's what happened in this case.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's, I really think it's just to avoid the bailout. I mean, like, when the DAO happened, it was pretty obvious to pretty much anybody on the sidelines, like, this fork was rushed and it was, you know, to try and stop these DAO funds from being drained. It was like, it was really like weird. It was like they had a month after the DAO attack and then they had to fork. And so it was really like they were pushing it and it just looked like a bailout, where if they did that again, I think they would just get even more bad publicity. And so why not just wait for this scheduled fork?
Well, Okay. The thing that I was just thinking about is because I heard someone saying that the reason they wouldn't hard fork specifically for parity, like an emergency hard fork, is because the reason they did it for the DAO is because they feared that the investors would sue them and there would be legal action and everything. But with these ICOs, like, how many of them do you think would have, like, that would not happen with these ICOs? How many of those ICOs do you think would actually be able to launch, like, a lawsuit against Ethereum or Parity? Because most of them are operating in a very gray area legal space already. So I think if they launched a lawsuit, they'd end up getting burned for that.
Yeah, I think that, like, Ethereum and the foundation have kind of covered their ass there with all the licenses and disclaimers, and we're not responsible. But I probably said this yesterday while I was drunk, but I need to say it again, that even Vlad Zafimir, in his own words, says that the most complicated thing that a team can reliably do is a multi-state wallet. And this is twice now that they've completely fucked it up.
The only thing they can do, and they can't even get that right. Yeah, and I just want to add one additional piece of information to what Rick was saying. The DAO was prevented from leaking very shortly after it started by the White Hacker Group, but then they needed to do the hard fork in order to bail out all the VIP investors who had lost money on it. And some of them, I'm led to believe, went all in on that shit. Put all the profits they'd made from Ethereum into the DAO and were facing losing all of it. And that was just too much. And so they had to roll back the chain, except they didn't actually roll it back. I know they didn't roll it back, but please don't ruin a perfectly good joke on a technicality. Nick Szabo, what's he saying? Internet routing has become far too centralized, not just a reliability problem. It is a security vulnerability. I'm not clicking on that link. What the fuck is that? No, that doesn't look safe.
No, it is safe. Oh.
Being a virus right now. Some mining Monero on my machine. It's mining Monero in the background.
Uh-oh. Well, at least somebody's making money off of it.
All right.
But see, this kind of ties into two things. The level 3 story you can show in a minute. But it also kind of feeds into the rationalization for setting up things like the Blockstream satellite feed and the radio relay that Nick Szabo and Elaine Hu were looking at Scaling Bitcoin over the weekend. And I think that the problem with level 3, if anybody here in North America had any problems with the internet the other day, pretty much the border gateway protocol. This is how, all right, let's wind back a little quicker. The internet is just a network of networks. So the overall global network of the internet is kind of encapsulating networks within it. And they all have to communicate with each other. And they do this by maintaining BGP tables, which are pretty much like the routing tables that routers at the edge of these individual networks. They store the paths between those smaller networks in the larger network. And one of the things when you're dealing with kind of traffic load on this global scale is you have to specifically manage these pathways or these routes that one network will follow to get information to another network containing a machine you want to talk to, so that they don't overload any specific pathway with too much bandwidth. Because like obviously it's a pipe. It can only fit so much through it metaphorically. And if you try to overload it, there's going to be a lot of problems. And so what happened here is some routes were leaked out into the BGP routing tables that were internal routes that were not meant for public traffic to be routed through. And when those routes got out there and traffic started being routed through them, it overloaded those pipelines. And so there was a lot of problems routing specific information for a lot of people in certain parts of the world yesterday. And this kind of all comes down to these routers are all managed by system administrators who have to set these tables up. And that is a big central point of control. Like as was shown with this instance yesterday with the level 3 network, this caused global problems for the entire internet when somebody fucked up just because of how it started moving traffic around. It started moving it around in ways that the underlying pipelines couldn't handle. And what Szabo was getting at with the initial site that Chris was showing is this isn't just a technical problem. This is a security risk. Because, like I said, there are people in control of these routing tables. There are people who run these networks. And at the end of the day, if somebody managing one of these tables or these networks doesn't want specific information to go through there, they can actually take courses of action to prevent that. they can slow down specific flows of information. Like there's actually like the Great Firewall of China literally uses deep packet inspection, where they literally look at the information contained in each individual packet moving through its routers and decide whether to let it through or not. And when we're talking about something like Bitcoin, which obviously like governments around the world are not happy about it. If they had a way to shut this down, they would take it. And one of those ways is seeing network infrastructure, which is very centralized in its control. Like if we just kind of wave that problem off and don't think about it and just go la 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 la, everything's going to be okay, eventually that's going to be a big problem when people who manage these backbone networks and these larger parts of the internet in the whole don't want to let the Bitcoin network function on it. And this is part of the entire rationale behind things like the Blockstream satellite feed, or like what Nick Szabo is working on in terms of, right? Like we can't just keep the network decentralized just on the internet, because it still depends on that physical infrastructure, which is still something that at the end of the day, somebody controls. And so we need these other physical mediums that are not just the internet pipes that we use to check Facebook or YouTube to rely on in the event that people don't want to let Bitcoin function. And like this is a very serious long-term problem that we actually need solutions for if we want this to work as a global currency system that is beyond the control of any one government.
Yeah, I'm with you. And sorry, it's like I was with you. I saw that Nick Szabo tweet and was pretty quick to sort of tie it to like trying to keep centralization issues out of Bitcoin, because I know that the internet is like it's a decentralized network and everything, but we sort of just sort of naturally started centralizing things. And I know that the level of centralization is kind of up for debate, but I think that it does kind of feel like we got everything in place to where the commercials are streaming in and money is going where it needs to go. Unless it breaks, they're not going to try and build redundancy systems for the internet. And I think that's, we were talking in the mumble with Nothing Much about mesh nets and how that could be helpful, just sort of building a redundancy in case some sort of problem like this does crop up again.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it really is a necessity. And I mean, this is like when you look at a problem with something, I mean, it's really important to think about the timelines that you're considering, because like something like this might not be a problem for the next year or two, but 5-10 years out, if Bitcoin barrels forward to something like a $1 trillion market cap, and we actually start implementing all of these features that let people use it as money and not just become some like clearinghouse for digital gold that only the rich can like afford to use, then that will be a problem, because they will consider that a threat and they will start looking for ways that they can undermine the physical infrastructure that it counts on.
That's pretty bad. I'm sorry, Janine. I was just going to say real quick that we were talking in the mumble how it's like you really have to run your own DNS server for a stable to make sure that, you know, this thing's going to work right.
Yeah, and I just want to point out that Nick Szabo and Elaine, is it Elaine? They designed a portable temporary antenna rig that they're going to be testing. I presume, I don't know how much testing they plan to do, but presumably in the next few months or years or so. And they're looking for volunteers. So if you want to help out to see if they can get Bitcoin on centralized radio network, then you should contact them.
Indubitably.
That's awesome. Like I like the fact that, you know, we got one way to transmit a transaction, and yeah, we're still got guys building redundancy all around. I like that. They need to do that for the internet.
How are we going to protect the world against Twitter support? What are we going to do about that? Whose story is this?
Major centralization issue.
Major.
Yeah, I just saw this today that because I was kind of surprised because I would have expected Twitter to have come to this realization a lot sooner, because it's like we've had this whole idea of the blue checkmark class for like at least a year, I think. But if anyone's not familiar, if you're not on Twitter, basically what the blue check mark means is that you're a verified person. That means that you've either, for some people, they've actually had to send their passport and ID information to Twitter to basically say, I'm a real person. I'm not a troll or a bot or anything. And so obviously Twitter intended it to be an authentication mechanism to say, this is the name matches who the person is that holds the account. But I've been verifying people has been pretty selective, because some people I've noticed, or some people have actually said that they never applied to be verified, but they got verified anyway. It was a surprise to them. And most of the people get verified are very influential public figures. So it's not just a matter of this is a real person. It's, is this person influential? That's what it to. And so you had this quote blue checkmark class that was people on Twitter that were the influencers. If you were an influencer, you had to have a blue check mark. Now, not all people that are influential on Twitter have a blue check mark, but a lot of them do. And so apparently Twitter has realized that this creates this whole class structure that they have now on their network has created a problem where people are now interpreting the blue check mark as some kind of endorsement from Twitter that they're an important person or that you should listen to them. And so now they're saying they're going to evaluate that that system, or maybe how they display the check mark, or I don't know what they're going to do. But I find it really surprising that they only us now and that they thought it was a problem, because I think this has been a problem for at least a year or two.
It's funny. I didn't even think about this, but I just like heard recently that we all got 280 characters instead of 140. And I wonder if that's them trying to like even the playing field before, you know, they take away the ticks or something. Cause that was the, at first it was, you got a tick and then it doubled your character limit. And I guess now everybody can have 280.
Yeah. And I don't I don't know if you guys saw this, but there was something else that they changed in, I think it was their policy somewhere. They used to have a line that says one of the intents of Twitter is to for people to be able to speak truth to power. And they recently removed that and replaced it with something like promote an open dialogue. And people thought that that was a very interesting change. And Twitter, there was a viral tweet that screen capped both of the original and then the change. And Twitter actually responded to that. And they said, oh, the new explanation is more understandable across cultural boundaries. There's like this really fishy answer. So
yeah, they're just trying to back down from the whole liberal slant on shit that they are very well known for. Because to comment on the verification of accounts, Sargon of Akkad, if anybody watches him, has literally been trying to get verified for like something like a year, and is completely ignored, like given BS responses whenever they respond to him. And last I checked, still wasn't verified. And so why is he getting all this shit when he is trivially able to provide proof that he is who he says he is? Well, I really have no explanation except his political means.
Well, I mean, in that, because Twitter is very careful about verifying account, because I don't think Sargon is his real name, right? Probably isn't.
I'm brain farting right now, but his real name is out there, and
I'm just saying that like Twitter usually is very hesitant, I've noticed, to verify accounts that are using like handles instead of real names or a company name or something like that. If it's a pseudonym, it takes a lot longer. Like I think they did it for malware tech. They recently the guy who was the hero of the NHS malware that was going around. He was the one that shut it down. And now he is still stuck in, I think, Los Angeles. But he recently got his GPS tracker off. He doesn't have to wear that anymore. But he got his account verified out of nowhere. He wasn't expecting it, and he still goes by MalwareTech. He doesn't use his real name that was leaked by these stupid British tabloids. But yeah, there's probably a political element to all of this about who they verify, because they have verified people that, like alt-right people that, or white, like out and out white supremacists that, yeah. So, you know, there is some political element to this, but, I think for most cases, it's going to be a question of, they have a problem with verifying people that use pseudonyms.
Okay.
I don't know where I'm going with this, but I mean, like, I've been reading like that Saudi guy, that guy got arrested, and it was something to do with like a big takeover of Twitter, or like the main stockholder of Twitter now is some Saudi guy. Yeah, I don't know. We'll get into that some other time, I guess.
Yeah, and we also reported before on a previous show that there's a market for getting verification tickers on different websites. Like, I think we looked at Instagram and Snapchat, and there's ways that you can like pay thousands of dollars to get verified. So that's also another element to this.
All right. Scaling Bitcoin. You said February, moon February, coffee February.
Coffee by February. Okay. So Shinobi Monkey has to acknowledge his limits and where he is stupid here. All I can do is give a rough conceptual explanation of this. I'm probably going to have to watch it another 3 or 4 times before I can explain the actual underlying cryptography used or the mechanics. But the long and short of Roast Beef's presentation here is, right now, with where Lightning Network stands, each update to a channel is pretty much a series of roughly like three transactions or so. You have the multi-sig that's actually been funded for the channel sending money to another multi-sig that's generated on the fly for each transaction through the channel that has time-locked outputs. So once that second multi-sig address or the transaction to it confirms, it'll confirm on the chain, and then things are locked. And then there's yet another series of transactions that move the money back to being independently controlled by both sides of the channel. And now effectively under this way of doing things, in order to actually maintain a channel, you have to save and make sure you save every like update. So every set of those three transactions until that channel closes. So pretty much to use a channel, you have a constantly growing amount of data and a set of private keys that you have to maintain in order to be able to securely like get your money if somebody tries to defraud you. Like pretty much like what will happen is when you move from one set of these or like a channel state to the next one, the private keys for that second set of transactions, the second multi-sig that things have to confirm to on chain before money goes to each party, what you do is you give the other side of those channel or that channel those private keys, so that if effectively like somebody tries to take an old state and rip you off, you can just sign an entirely new transaction that doesn't have anything time locked and take all of the money. But this is obviously, it gets very expensive at scale, because any user has to keep all of these states and these sets of keys secure. Otherwise, like let's say you lose somebody could go submit a earlier state of the channel and steal your money, and you won't have the keys that you need to confiscate that money before his withdrawal of it confirms. And this also has a lot of complications for outsourcing your payment channels or monitoring them to a full node. Because for every channel that a node monitors under this model, it has to continually store a growing amount of data for every single channel that it's monitoring. And like I said, acknowledging my bounds here, got to watch this a few more times to actually explain the underlying mechanics. But what Roast Beef is saying is that he thinks he has a mechanic now where you can safely prevent somebody from submitting an old channel state and ripping you off without having to keep all of that data. So that he thinks there's a new way to structure this where you can securely ensure that you can't have a previous state submitted to defraud you with a static amount of data. So now the data cost of actually using a channel securely from the user's point of view are a lot less because they only have to keep like the current state and the like a previous one that would be valid to negate like a theft attempt. And most importantly, for full nodes that watch channels for other people, this really helps because they only have to keep a static amount of data for each channel they're watching instead of that exponentially growing amount of data for all the channels. And like, so yes, this is huge in terms of like making Lightning Network way more efficient while maintaining the security model of things. And probably going to watch this a bunch more times and actually get to the point where I can explain the underlying dynamics mechanically. But I highly recommend everybody watch this. Just put it on half speed or something because Roast Beef talks really fast.
Yeah, he really fucking does. Like, he's a genius, but man, I have to watch this shit like 3 times before I understand it. James Bond has a couple of questions. He goes, Monk, wow. I think that's just because he's impressed with you. That's going to be a lot of data. If you keep that channel open, you will have to close at some point.
Well, yeah, you would without having to keep all of that data. And like, that's kind of the thing, like from an individual user's point of view, it's not really that bad in terms of keeping the data. It's more that like, if something happens to it, you're now exposed to the potential of getting ripped off. Like the real wow factor here is for full nodes that will watch things for other people. Because ideally in the long term, that's going to become kind of a standard feature for a node to be able to do that. And without this improvement that Roast Beef is saying he found, that like that adds more cost to running a node than 2x would have, just bloating things up to 8 megabytes. And so it's kind of nice to have that saving from the client side, but it's a lot more impactful from the point of view of a full node that's watching other people's channels so that people can use this without using their own full node.
And he also asks, does that not defeat the usefulness of the Lightning Network?
No, I mean, it's a little more nuanced. Like it doesn't defeat the usefulness of it in terms of like not pushing all of that cost onto the main chain. It's just there is that cost of the data that you have to save in order to be able to stop somebody from stealing from you. And yeah, what Roast Beef thinks he...
Go on.
But like what Roast Beef thinks he figured out here kind of drastically reduces the amount of data cost there.
Right, okay. I mean, I think James is just mostly concerned about how he's going to pay his hooker by the sounds of it.
Don't worry.
If you want to open a channel with my favorite hooker, I thought Lightning would be useful, but I guess not. No, I guess you just have to do it all on chain and just pay the fees. Or just pay with Bitcoin Cash. That's it.
You just get a bunch of open dimes.
Yeah, open dimes. You can use open dimes.
Just slip them in your inner waistband.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to the next story. Whose is this story? What is this?
This is a series of really people struggling to accept reality in the wake of 2x imploding.
Well, Peter Smith is a really cool guy. He told me to use Ethereum because it's better for like transactions. Well, go on then. Say something. React.
I think it's like just shows the ignorance of these guys that, you know, we're really pushing SegWit2x and how, you know, it's suspended right now. And they still have, you know, these arguments that are just sort of nonsensical. And I started posting them to the news desk because I don't know. It triggered me, and I guess I just wanted to trigger everyone else so that they could see this, because it's really aggravating when it's like, you know, we think that everybody's kind of got the same idea about this, and then, you know, okay, so it's suspended because we all kind of got the same idea, and then the day after, here comes these, I don't know, these nonsensical arguments.
Okay. I see it. We lost
Monkey. Steve Smith is a bad, bad man. Oh. He's a very bad man. Bad man.
Were you ranting that whole time? We just couldn't hear you?
I was responding to something in the control box. But Peter Smith really, really bugs the shit out of me. Because he was a huge, influential person as far as pushing the New York Agreement forward. He just wasn't very public about it. And what I see going on right now is an attempt for him to kind of like build up his reputation, not having been so publicly connected to 2X, and continue trying to press core, air quotes, for things they've fucked up on. Like, for instance, I think that's me responding to him talking about having developed for Lightning Network. They didn't do shit for Lightning Network. They implemented a half-assed, non-spec compliant thing like Lightning Network called Thunder, which is heavily centralized and not really functional on the network. And they still haven't implemented SegWit. So, and oh no, this is this is him talking about decentralization and censorship resistance. Like he's sitting here requesting an objective definition of these things, which is ridiculous. Because these things are obviously spectrums. You cannot perfectly quantify something like decentralization or censorship resistant. You can only decide that you want to be as far on that spectrum towards decentralization or censorship resistant as humanly possible. And the entire way in which him and a lot of the other people involved in the 2X agreement act, they don't want to be as close to decentralization or as close to censorship resistance as possible. They simply want to push and externalize their operational costs onto the commons that is a validating node. And they don't care about decentralization. They don't care about censorship resistance. They just want to turn Bitcoin into some kind of pump and dump Ponzi scheme where, hey guys, don't think logically. Don't look at the fact that something that's decentralized will always be less efficient than a centralized thing. It's going to work, guys. Let's just destroy that decentralized censorship resistant quality that makes this valuable in the first place, because our business will be able to afford to keep going. And it's just one of the most disingenuous arguments that a person could make in the space. If you don't appreciate the spectrum that is decentralization or the spectrum that is censorship resistance, then you're in the wrong place. And you need to really reassess why you're in this ecosystem.
There were a couple of tweets that stood out to me. One of them was by Charlie Lee, who says the companies behind SegWit2x, and he lists them, all have business models that depend on low transaction fees. They're in the prime position to help Bitcoin scale by building out layer two infrastructure, which reduces fees. But then he goes on to say, instead, they keep pushing for on-chain scaling, which externalizes the cost to everyone else that's part of this decentralized network. I'm calling all of you out right now. Do the right thing, implement SegWit, and work on Lightning Network and other layer two solutions. I also want to point out this tweet that I found on the interwebs as well, which actually goes, do you see this? Which actually goes to showcase some of the history of how the internet was first invented and how you had these, the OSI stack, and you had IBM's SNA, and you had DEC's DECnet, but it was actually the internet itself was actually the OSI committee-based process, which was like a more nimble, more decentralized process, was the one that won out in the end.
Yeah, so I mean, this is exactly. Like the exact same type of contention and arguing and company interests trying to push things beneficial to them. Like all of this is exactly how we got the protocol stacks and the internet that we have today. It's the same shit. And like, I mean, like there were literally fist fights at some of the fucking conferences, like back in the, I'm not kidding, there were in like the early 90s, the late 80s when, or, all right, those timetables might be off, but like you get my point. Like there were fist fights. Just proving
how young you are. You weren't even alive, were you?
I was alive.
You're a young man. You're a young man.
Yeah. But my point is, though, like this, there were fist fights over how the internet should be designed. And just this idea that we should all just shut up and just do what these big companies say. It's ridiculous. We're not going to shut up. We're not going to just relent to these big corporate interests. And we're going to build something workable. Because that is exactly how we have the internet today. And we're not just going to bow down and let these interests destroy it. Because we've seen that we can win before. We wouldn't have the internet otherwise.
But what about our founding father, Satoshi Wright? I mean, Satoshi Nakamoto. I mean, Craig Wright. Fake I mean,
Satoshi.
What?
Fake Satoshi.
No, I don't want to get sued. what's he saying? It's the 2018 is the year of unstoppable global payments. As Bitcoin Cash scales, it is about to become unstoppable. Fast, low cost or free. What bullshit is this? Come on. You can put this on the news.
Craig Wright is out of his mind. Like he is a legit crazy person.
280 characters are wasted on him.
Don't worry.
Okay.
Don't worry, guys. We got our gigablocks. We proved that our gigablocks are work.
No, there was that tweet that I don't know who's that Hufu guy that said, you know, it's funny how quick the 2x guys were to drop that. Yeah, that tweet. Like when I saw that, I was like, yeah, that's quite an interesting comment.
Hmm. All right.
One thing, one last thing. Wasn't in the show notes, but I think that this definitely bears publicly commenting. I just threw the link in the chat, Chris. But hey guys, Jihan admitted it. He admitted it. Miners are not in control. See, he said it right there himself. So for all time, forever and ever, any argument that tries to imply that, no. The biggest miners said they're not. It's right there. It's black and white. He said that exactly.
Got it. Have we archived that? Someone archived that.
Please, please.
Of course.
Cool. I love this. I'm just going to show this animated GIF. Right. Next story. Whose is this? Is this Charnine's?
Yeah, well, if Shinobi wants to start, because he actually found the article, do you want to start, Shinobi?
Nah, you can take it. I'm going to round it out.
Okay, so this is an article from Ars Technica, which is one of the few tech publications that I can actually read without getting angry most of the time. And it's written by Timothy B. Lee. And he basically wrote an article about the end of this whole SegWit2x badness, and there were several problems that I had with it. If we want to, if you can bring up the actual article, go through it. So he starts off, a group of prominent developers and executives backing a plan to expand the capacity of the Bitcoin network threw in the towel on Wednesday. It's clear. He basically quotes Mike Belshi. And so I'm not going to read everything, but one of the things that immediately stood out to me is that he tried to give names to the different sides, and they were really arbitrary and weird. The first one he uses, I believe, was Bitcoin purists. So he says, Bitcoin purists worry that raising the block limit will raise the cost of participating in Bitcoin's peer-to-peer network, effectively shifting power to larger players in the Bitcoin ecosystem. First of all, that's not a belief or a worry. It's a demonstrable fact. If you raise the block size, there is not capacity, and the nodes cannot, the So nodes cannot verify. Sorry, I'm kidding.
It's okay.
Sorry. If the nodes cannot verify blocks at a fast enough speed, then they basically get work. And so to call us Bitcoin purists is a really weird term. And then he later goes on to say that we're not purists, we're traditionalists. So he says opposing them, we're opposing 2x, were Bitcoin traditionalists who argued that raising the block size could permanently change the network for the worse. So it's all about, you know, he's establishing these categories. What he calls the SegWit2x crowd is apparently Bitcoin pragmatists. They're pragmatic, you see, which I found really interesting. There, and also there's no mention of the only actually person I think is named is Alex Marcos and then Mike Hearn. He mentions Mike Hearn leaving as if that's somehow significant, like he saw the problems that he thinks there are with Bitcoin now early, which I find laughable, as we've discussed previously on the show. And then the kicker at the very end is obviously what he quoted in his tweet, where he says, for a lot of people, Bitcoin's original selling point was its potential to undermine the power of the financial establishment in the United States and around the world. It was probably inevitable that once Bitcoin developed its own homegrown business establishment, the same populist fervor would turn on them, which I find great, because also the Ars Technica founder, John Stokes, he compared Bitcoin to Occupy, saying that Bitcoin will fail like Occupy because it was too decentralized and it didn't like to pander to elites and a bunch of stuff like that. And so I want to, this is the crux of my comment on this entire article, I want to introduce or remind people of the concept of exit voice and loyalty, which is not a concept I came up with. I'll share it really quick in the description. But when you're dealing with economics or politics or an organization, you basically have three choices. In the terms of politics, mostly people focus on exit and voice. So when you have voice, that means that one of your options when you're facing a dilemma in an organization or in a state or anything is you can voice your opinion, you can show dissent, you can go to protests. So I will categorize Occupy as voice. That's what they did. They organized in public spaces and they voiced their dissent. If dissent like that fails, then you're other option is exit. That means you exit the system, you go to alternatives, you leave. That's what Bitcoin is. Bitcoin is an exit. So to compare Bitcoin to Occupy is, I think, a failure of understanding of what these systems are at a fundamental level. Because Occupy failed because voice failed, and Bitcoin has not failed. Bitcoin has gone on now for almost 9 years. And it has not failed like Occupy. And to categorize the failure of the SegWit2x so-called upgrade as a failure of Bitcoin, I think is completely missing the point. It's actually the opposite case. The reason that SegWit2x failed is because we realized it was going to hinder decentralization. It was going to be a threat to the network. It was going to increase the risk of centralization. That's why we didn't agree with it. So I find, yeah, that was one of the biggest things that I found really infuriating about that article.
There's a really good quote in the chat by Luke Townley who says that Bitcoin is vacate Wall Street, exit mm-hmm. Wall Street.
But like it's the same kind of cognitive dissonance that like the people leading the 2X movement have. They just can't grok the concept of like leadership without leaders, of rules without rulers, of like a decentralized anarchic system. And that's the entire point of this. Like Bitcoin isn't going to fail because we refuse to cave in and relent to hierarchies. It's going to fail if we do so, because the entire point of it is to have like the rules without rulers. And it's like these people are going to slowly wake up. I mean, it's been a constant trend in my personal experience that the longer time has marched on, the more and more people who didn't realize that, they wake up and realize it. I mean, like, even in my own personal life, like, there's a friend of mine I've been trying to convince to get into Bitcoin since I got here like 4 years ago. I finally got him in right before like shit skyrocketed at the end of this year, like right when China announced the exchange shutdown for the first part of the year. And he woke up. He eventually, it clicked. And all like, eventually for people like this, it's going to click. And they're finally going to get it. Because, like, I'm not stopping. Like, I'm not going anywhere. And I don't think anybody else here is going to either.
Indeed. Are we not stopping the show, though? Or what's going to happen? Are we just going to keep on going?
No, we're going to go forever and ever. We're going to turn this into like a podcast of our lives.
It'll be like a Richard Hart show. We'll just go on for like 8 hours.
Quality of this mic.
Quite, yeah, you need to get a really good candlestick.
Good quality mic. Look at the quality of the Shure mic.
Yeah, need to get some really good furniture. Need to upgrade ourselves. Right. Final thoughts.
I need a mic.
Yeah, Agnix needs to get a new mic. Yes, that's true. Rick, what are you saying?
I'm saying I had one. Now I'm like, I forgot to write it down today. So my final thought is I need to write down my final thoughts. Sorry, people.
All right. Well, look, thanks very much for watching. If you want to follow us, you can follow us on Twitter. It's right here at Block Digest. The great graphics are made by Rick before each show. But you can also join us as well in the Bitcoin Mumble chat during the day where the conversation never stops. And it's bitcoinmumble.com, and all the description to all the goodness and the links and everything is in the description below. If you liked and enjoyed what you saw today, you can hit the like button and subscribe. But remember, only if you want to. Bye for now.